started out poor, barefoot, dressed in sackcloth, but James Brown was destined to reign supreme as a music icon.
This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
A new biography about the godfather of soul reveals what James Brown sought for so long to hide, his roots. Author James McBride writes that the facts of Brown's life have become, quote, twisted like a pretzel beyond recognition. He tries to set the record straight with the book Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. And James McBride joins me now from Philadelphia. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can we start with the title, Kill 'Em and Leave, which from your book was a direct quote from James Brown himself. What was he referring to?
He was referring to when he was telling Reverend Al Sharpton, who stayed with him for 15 years, about how to approach performances and how to basically approach life, which is to come important and leave important. When the audience, when he performed, he would make sure the band had the audience warmed up and all lubed up. Then he would kill him, and then when he was done, he would leave. He would often do his hair before he left, but he would leave. He wasn't one to stick around and say hi to stars and take pictures with people and so forth.
And you make the argument in your book that, as you said, that's not just his style to performing, but his style to life as well. Why do you say that?
Well, James Brown was very hard to know. He didn't want people to know who he was for a lot of reasons. He hid certain parts of his personality and certain parts of his life because he was just a private person and a very proud person. Much of what has been written about him, while some of it is good and some of it, you know, accurately tracks his, you know, he recorded this song then and he got married at this time and so forth, doesn't really speak to who the man really is and was. And I think our inability to really understand James Brown is rooted in our inability to talk about the difficult things that we manage to avoid talking about, like race and class and the division between North and South. And that's why he's been so hard to capture for writers in the past.
So you start out the book really swinging. I mean, what I mean that is you hold no punches. You start out by saying that in Augusta, the town most people think of as his hometown, that you say there's nothing left of James Brown there, and the place that was his birthplace, although they understand the man, they want nothing to do with him. And you also have some fairly harsh things to say about Mick Jagger as well. Were you concerned about the way other people might read your book or their reactions to it?
I mean, the truth travels in a straight line. Charles Bobbitt, who was James Brown's manager for 41 years, and a Georgia resident, I might add, said that James Brown never really liked Mick Jagger at all. And so Mick Jagger produced a movie about James Brown, a great deal of which was pretty much appears to be fiction. The depiction of him, and his imprisonment and how he went to jail that last time, driving through two North Georgia State police cars, depicting his father as this sort of violent, you know, man who sits there singing songs plucked straight from Alan Lomax's Mississippi Chain Gang recordings made in prison in Mississippi. I mean, these are just sort of stereotypical views of a man who was a lot deeper and a lot more complicated.
Let me play you a clip of James Brown speaking. This is from an interview with WSB-TV in 1968, and he's talking about sort of his own rags-to-riches story.
My experience was like a teaching, but it was also luck. It's too much of a miracle, and it's hard. Miracles just don't happen, but in my case, it did. I believe, well, I know that a man has to think right and live right to survive.
I mean, as you alluded to, one of the things that really comes out in your book is how often James Brown himself obscured the truth. I mean, you describe the number of different ways he would tell the exact same story with different facts and different people starring in those stories. He himself seemed to have created some of the fictions about himself.
A lot of what he said about the way he grew up was true. But, you know, poverty is a very raggedy experience. I mean, you're living with one cousin for a while, you go here, you go there. I mean, for example, his whole business with, you know, in the movie, it portrays James Brown as living in the basement of Bobby Bird's house after he got out of prison. Now, James Brown got out of prison in 1951. Please, Please, Please was released in 1955. He did not live in Bobby Bird's basement for 4 years. Bobby Bird at the time was going to school, in part, at least in at North Carolina A&T. James Brown was married. He had a wife. He had two children. He worked as a janitor at the Toccoa Elementary School. And he did that for 4 years while he was putting his career together and making a go of it with the Famous Flames. You know, that's never even talked about because his first wife has never done interview. I mean, she did an interview and she appears in this book. And she speaks very candidly about the fact that, you know, a lot of his life has been skewed so much that no one, very few people know what the facts are. And so she straightens a lot of that out.
Well, let's take a listen to the song that you referenced, which is his first hit, which was Please, Please, Please.
Please, 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 please.
Recorded before he was really James Brown, we think of as James Brown. But I also want to play you this clip when he was sort of creating the kind of performer he would be. He spoke in 2005 on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and he talked about the origin of his splits, the trademark splits that he does. And he says they came actually from baseball.
Jackie Robinson, the first black man, came to Major League Baseball, and he was doing a split on first base. There was another black baseball team called the Indianapolis Clowns and the Kansas City Monarchs before black. Those were Negro Leagues. And eventually when Robinson got into Major League Baseball, he brought some of those traits with him.
What did you discover, James, about the crafting of James Brown, the performer?
He got his performance stuff from a lot of different places. But his life and the way his life was conducted and what happened to him both in life and in death is really a metaphor for what is wrong in America. Because over the years, first of all, James Brown was never on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine until he died. This man is an international piece. He's like a noun. House, car, boat, James Brown, television. I mean, that's how big he is. But because the facts of his life have been skewed so badly, and not mostly by him, but by others who have written about him or talked about him, we really don't know who he is. And during his life, it didn't matter to him that much. But, you know, now that he's dead, well, it means a lot, in part because he left everything, his entire estate, to educate poor people in South Carolina and Georgia.
Yeah,
and that was 10 years ago.
And you have some harsh things to say about the people who've been fighting over his money. My guest is James McBride. He's the author of the new biography, Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. And James, you've given me a perfect segue to talk about really the game changer for James Brown, which is the song Say It Loud, I'm Black and Proud. So let's first take a listen. Play you again. This is from his 2005 interview on Fresh Air, where he's talking about where this song, the roots of this song.
I was in L.A. and during that time, some police shot four or five Muslims. So I written a recorder, said loud and black and proud, and tried to send a message not only to the white but to the black as well that pride was important and not power. The word power and pride was so misunderstood.
What do you make of his position, especially during a time of such turbulent change in race relations in this country, of the line that James Brown walked on that?
You know, he did his best. I mean, he I don't know, it was sort of about a, I don't know if it's a question of a line. I mean, the guy represented every song and every purpose that African Americans wanted. He was proud. He loved you. You know, he was like the uncle from down south who shows up and pulls out his teeth and gets drunk and says, "Stay in school." You know, I mean, you know, you loved him and you know he loved you. So I'm not sure if it's a question of, I mean, he might have to explain to the white media what, you know, with the words power and all this, this, that, and the other. But the song speaks for itself. You know, be proud of who you are and say it loud. You don't say it softly. I don't feel like he walked the line. There was no line for the man to walk. He created a line. He created a road. He did it himself.
And he had high standards, not only, as you say, for education, which he emphasized his whole life and even after death, but you tell a story of him talking to a couple kids in New York City and telling them to pull their britches up where they ought to be and turn your caps in the direction you're walking and you'll be a lot better off, he told them. Is that a true story? Do we know if that really
happened? Yeah, it's true. I mean, listen, everything in the book is true, first of all. And secondly, we still haven't talked about the fact that the man left at least $100 million to educate poor children in South Carolina and Georgia 10 years ago, and not a single dime has reached these children. That's part of the reason why I wrote this book, because the man created a trust that was supposed to get these children educated. And 10 years later, not a single... Now, listen, the guy worked 45 years, and his money is being used by lawyers. And you say harsh words. These are not harsh words. Just straight up and down truth. Now, Georgia has a stake in this as well. And the state of Georgia basically walked away and let the state of South Carolina sort of duke this out. And they've just been milking this dairy cow of the James Brown estate for 10 years. But he was real clear about what he wanted to happen to his estate when he died. He wanted money to set up, and he said he left everything, his likeness, everything, his publishing, his music, all of that to set up a trust to educate poor children in South Carolina and Georgia. That was 10 years ago. He spent $20,000 putting together an airtight will to do it, and it hasn't happened. Now, that to me is more important than James Brown singing in 1968, "Say It Loud and Proud." Listen, as a black person, I'm not interested in talking about problems. I only want to talk about solutions. And one of the reasons why I did this book was because it's clear that this man spent a lot of his life killing himself for a community that he cared about, including the community of Augusta, a place that he loved. And to this day, not much has happened with this guy's money, because lawyers and some of his children have sued his estate, and they have tied this thing up in court for years. And they are, look, we're talking about 48 lawsuits, 4,000 pages of testimony, 90 attorneys, most of whom never even knew James Brown. What about that?
Well, let me actually play you a clip. I spoke with Deanna Brown Thomas, who's one of James Brown's daughters. She was talking to me about his educational efforts and his foundation. And she described to me actually the level of poverty that her dad experienced as a kid, which she says is why he was so generous.
There was no such thing as Christmas gifts, new bicycles, and all the fun stuff that, you know, we want to see as kids when it's Christmas morning. That wasn't happening in my father's home as a child. So when he got older and became who he was, God blessed him so much, he realized to who much is given, much is expected. He was one who made it out of the ghetto. He was one who made it out. There were many who didn't, and he didn't want to forget those. So he never forgot where he came from.
Deanna says that money is making it to kids who need it. What's your response?
What is my response? It's pretty clear the money's not making it to the kids. There's a reporter in South Carolina named Sue Summer who works for a paper called the Newbury Observer. She has been following this case. She's the only one, a 62-year-old white grandmother, has been the only reporter following this case for the last 10 years. And they've tried to throw her in jail twice. Her clippings are on Facebook and the Newbury Observer. Very clear that none of this money has reached these kids. Not this money. This James Brown Foundation that he set up is not, it's not working, because it's because his estate is being run by the state of South Carolina. There's a trustee that runs his estate that does everything. That's just straight up and down fact. Now, I can't make it any more clear. And it's nice that, you know, we know about he was poor, and we know all of that. Again, let's go with what Joseph Lowery said at the Million Man March. My house is on fire. My children are in it. I don't care who gives me water. What is happening with it now? We know James Brown was poor. If he were living, he would not want us to talk about him being poor. He would want to say, I work for this money. It belongs to these kids. What happened? Real clear. Can't get clearer than that.
That is James McBride. He's the author of Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. James, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The foundation James McBride talked about is the I Feel Good Trust. That's an educational charity. Its scholarships are supposed to go to needy kids in Georgia and South Carolina, and McBride says that hasn't happened. Sue Summer, a reporter with the Newbury Observer in South Carolina, agrees with McBride. She's been following this story. She tells us a South Carolina judge approved a deal to take more than half of James Brown's music empire away from the I Feel Good Trust. The state Supreme Court overturned that decision in 2013. But because of pending litigation, those funds still are not going to the charity. We'll keep you updated as that story develops. And that's our show for today. But look, I happen to know we have some really great singers among our audience out there. So I want to hear your best James Brown impression. And come on, you know you have a good one. You're going to have to call us and leave a message because you can't tweet this one. Call us at 404-500-9457. It's 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day. I feel good. Heh. You need some love for your tension ease. What's that?